Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. The story we present this month was the winner of a second-place scroll in the 2015 EQMM Readers Award competition. Its author, Brendan Du Bois, got his start as a writer in our magazine's Department of First Stories in 1986. Since then, he has produced more than 150 published short stories, for which he's won multiple Seamus Awards, and also some 24 critically acclaimed novels. When he traveled to New York City this past May to receive his Reader's Award, the New Hampshire author recorded this winning story, The Lake Tenant, from the November 2015 issue of EQMM.
More than 5 years after the unexplained events occurred along the shores of Walker Pond in eastern New Hampshire, the exact facts of what happened and who was involved was still topic number one among gossipers at the Volunteer Fire Department, the Town Hall, the Grange, and the Miss Walker Diner. Yet all of the talk, discussion, and theories of what really happened and why it happened all came back to a fact everyone could agree on. It all started when a man named Russ Fox rented the old Tucker place at Warner's Point for the summer. The house is really too big for one person, but the descendants of Homer Tucker, who made and lost a fortune on Wall Street back in the 1930s, didn't mind that the place was being rented by a single man. It was better than renting it out on a weekly basis to college students from away, who thought crossing the New Hampshire border gave them diplomatic immunity from having loud parties, dumping trash into nearby yards, and otherwise raising hell among the year-round residents. Plus, the man claiming to be Russ Fox wanted to rent for the entire summer, eliciting a sigh of relief from the Tucker descendants, who wouldn't have to worry about answering summer rental inquiries, and he paid in cash. At O'Hallen Realty in late April, he politely asked that a routine background check on him be skipped, for privacy reasons, he shyly explained, and for which he paid a 10% cash bonus. Before the rental agent could reply about how the rules really required a background check, the Tucker descendant took the cash, gave the man a key, and said, "See you after Labor Day." And Russ Fox nodded, dimples in his smile, and said, "It'll be in great shape when I leave, I promise." Things remained quiet for a while after that, with only a few sightings of Russ Fox here and there. He had a small blue Ford Escort that he drove to the hardware store and the local gas-and-go mini-mart, but never to the post office or to the town hall. He seemed to be an exercise fiend and was often seen early in the morning, running along the dirt roads that encircled Walker Pond, which in fact was larger than some lakes in the state. Polly Denton, a waitress who lived on Potter Road, said Russ looked to be in his 30s, while Kyle Tucker, who gave Russ the keys to the Tucker house for the summer, said he was in his late 50s. But all agreed that he was a sight to see, clad in black running shorts, socks, and running shoes, and nothing else, jogging along the roads. He was muscular, tanned, with close-cropped black hair and scars in his legs and abdomen. And he never ran in any particular pattern. Some days he trotted alongside the fine homes and cottages of Potter Road, and other times he went through the narrow dirt lanes of Hearth Harbor Road, which held battered cottages and mobile homes that hadn't been mobile for about 30 years. He also seemed to enjoy kayaking, traveling along the shoreline of the pond, skimming in and out of the coves and inlets, expertly paddling along sunken boulders and old tree stumps that had torn out the hulls of generations of watercraft on Walker Pond. While paddling around, he had a set of binoculars around his strong neck, and he was seen on several occasions checking out the loons in the pond, and a bald eagle that had set up temporary quarters on a tall pine tree on Spencer's Island. After a week or so, after the townspeople got used to seeing him running around the lake and paddling and shopping at the local Gas and Go, some gossipers started wondering why he was there and what he was doing. Blair McCann, who worked as a meter reader for PSNH, said that he came by the Tucker house one day and saw Russ typing madly away on a laptop while sitting on the rear deck, which made some think he was a writer. But Tracy Keene, whose daughter Kim was in the Girl Scouts and went out to the place selling cookies, she told the customers at the Miss Walker Diner that she spotted Russ sitting by the water's edge, drawing on a large sketch pad. So maybe he was an artist, or maybe a school teacher or professor taking the summer off. Although he probably didn't know it, Russ Fox quickly became a person of interest at Walker Pond that summer, causing equal amounts of fascination and frustration. Fascination because the guy pretty much kept to himself, and frustration because, well, damn it, in this part of New Hampshire, neighbors never ever went up to someone and asked them what he or she did for a living. It was just not done. And if somebody wanted to move into a cottage and stay inside most days and nights, like Kurt Dunson, who moved in 20 years earlier and was rarely seen by anybody, even at town meeting, or if she kept 21 cats, like Donna Gardner, or never cut his hair or shaved his beard, like Billy Wren, well, that was his or her business. And minding one's business was pretty much rule number one, save for one exception. Gossip, of course, was allowed and encouraged. During the Memorial Day weekend, Russ Fox did something that caused the gossip quotient to increase by about 50%, and increased the frustration factor the same amount. To this day, exactly what happened remains an open question, but what is known is that it involved neighbors of Russ Fox, the Jordans, who lived at the next cove over. The most complete story came from Pam Heller, who worked at the Miss Walker Diner, and as she said, "Well, Zach Jordan came in one day and told me that there was this group of college kids from away who liked to moor their pontoon boat in their cove and raise hell all day. Loud music, shouts, jumping in the lake. You know Zach's wife, Marion, this is probably her last summer up here, and Zach just loves her to death. And he took his canoe out there and asked them if they would move their boat so she could rest in quiet. Well, they gave him a ration of shit, even though the poor old bean dropped into Normandy back in 44, and he was crackling tears over that." So what happened then came the question, about a half a dozen times that day from different folks at the diner. Well, somehow Russ Fox found out about what had happened, and one day he paddled his kayak over and had a talk with the college kids in the pontoon boat, and then they left. I guess he threatened something awful. How and what Russ said to the students on the pontoon boat remains in dispute to this day. Karen Sheldon said she heard that Russ told the kids that there were 7 on board, and if they didn't leave right away, only 6 of them would be going home that day. Pete Mulligan, he said he heard that Russ picked up a small cooler and told him that if they didn't leave, he'd leave instead, with somebody's head in the cooler. And Polly Bain, she said, everybody's wrong. She heard that Russ gave him a Ben Franklin and asked him politely to leave, and that's what happened. The fact that violence may have been threatened didn't bother the folks of Walker Pond that much. There was just a police chief and 2 auxiliary cops in the summer, and most disputes in town either got settled over beers, through fistfights, or in a small claims court. And what was funny is that the hint of violence about Russ Fox intrigued a number of single and barely single women in and around Walker Pond. A final number was never secured, but after the investigations to what eventually happened were concluded, word leaked out from a state senator with ties to the New Hampshire State Police that Russ had enjoyed the company of at least a dozen women during his time in Walker Pond that summer. And from each of the women, well, the tales they told about Russ. He came from Boston, L.A., Boca Raton, or places in between. He had been a semi-pro football player, an accountant, or a college poetry instructor. He was single, widowed, or divorced. But the women all said that he was polite, strong, and enjoyed making breakfast for them the next day. Cassie Trout, who once worked for the Ford Models Agency during the day, supposedly told investigators, "Hell, he was polite, had good teeth and breath, trimmed his toenails, and actually listened and tried to please me. That put him ahead of about 99% of the bachelors around here." And his reputed cooking skills came to the fore about a week or two after the pontoon boat incident, when the Walker Pond Volunteer Fire Department had a ham and bean supper as a fundraiser of $5 per head. And Russ Fox came in with 2 mouth-watering spice hams that he expertly carved up and passed out to the residents in attendance. He said the ham came from a secret family recipe, and more than one older woman tried to beg the recipe from him with no success. The ham and bean supper took place in the equipment bay of the Walker Pond Volunteer Fire Department after they moved out the ambulance, the 2 pumper trucks, and the forestry vehicle. Folding tables and chairs were set up, and the handsome and muscular Russ Fox easily moved around the townspeople wearing khaki shorts, topsiders with no socks, and a bright red golf shirt, with an apron wrapped around him that said, "Kiss the cook." A few of the more forward ladies, single and married, whispered to each other that they'd like to do more than just kiss the cook. Gracie Poulton, nearing 60 years of age, said that she'd like to kiss the cook, jump the cook, and drain the cook, leaving him in an exhausted and happy daze. That caused the ladies at her table to shriek with laughter. And when her husband Mike stopped by and asked what was so funny, The ladies just laughed some more, and Gracie told her hubby that she'd just belched something awful, and that's all. Afterwards, Russ stayed behind and helped pack up the leftovers, clean off the tables, fold and stack them up, along with the chairs. He swept the floor of the equipment bay and helped wash and dry the dishes, and when everything had been put back into its place, he asked to see Gus Demers, the chief of the volunteer fire department, whereupon they had a discussion that, alas, soured things some. A number of volunteer firefighters and their wives are in attendance, so we have a pretty good idea of what was said. Russ went up to Gus and said, "I'd like to join the fire department." Gus, who had been chief for 15 years and had probably had a couple of pops before coming over to the supper, said, "Why's that?" "I like this place," Russ said, "and I like the lake. I like to give back to the community, simple as that." "You got any firefighting experience?" "Plenty," Russ said.
"Where?"
"Oh, here and there," Russ said. Gus's fat eyes narrowed as he stuck his hands into his pockets. "You moving here full time?" "No," Russ said, and for the first time since he had moved into the Tucker place, he seemed hesitant, not sure of himself. Gus shook his head.
"Sorry, you got to be a town resident, not a renter or a tenant."
Well, most of the people watching this unfold saw Russ's face turn red, and it seemed like he grew a couple inches and that every muscle and tendon tightened up, ready to cut loose. Most suspected a real Donnybrook, but instead Russ nodded briskly, turned away, and walked out into the night. But that wasn't the end of it. For one thing, a couple of volunteer lieutenants and captains went up to Gus and asked him why was he being such a hard ass. Trey Boggins, he told the chief that the department could use an extra hand, even if it was just for the summer, since those idiot tourists tend down to burn down a cottage or two before the season was out. Kelly Smith, he said, "No offense, chief, but all the guys we have on call have bigger bellies than they should. It would be great to have a guy who could haul a hose or pull a ceiling without passing out." And Tommy Lamontagne, he said, "Christ, chief, most of the guys on call during the day work out of town. It takes a while to drive back to the station when an alarm gets struck. Russ Fox, whatever the hell it is that he does, well, at least he's local." And Gus hung his thumbs in his wide waistband and said, "That's the way it's going to be. And if you have any problems with that, bring it up to the fire commission. I'm sure they'd be glad to take any resignations that get offered if you don't like the outcome." Well, everybody shut their mouths then and left, because everybody who served on the five-member board fire commission, which supposedly ran the volunteer fire department, was related to Gus Demers by blood or marriage. And anybody who got called up to the commission, more often than not, was ordered to bring their boots, turnout gear, and helmet, because you were through. Now, that would be a hell of a thing, which doesn't make sense to those from away, since after all, it was volunteer. Nobody got paid for nothing. You did training and drills on your own spare time. But for those in a small town like Walker Pond, being a volunteer firefighter was a source of pride. It showed that you were a real part of the community, somebody who went the extra distance to help people. Plus, most folks, they love the firefighters, unlike other officials in town. If a selectman or a cop or a building inspector or a zoning board member showed up at your door, that often meant trouble. Of course, having a volunteer firefighter show up at your door meant trouble as well, but they were there to help. Even it meant coming out at 3 a.m. in a crazy snowstorm in the middle of February to put out a chimney fire. So there was that, plus the added bennies of marching in parades in the spring and summer, having pretty girls take your picture, and what they really liked, although nobody really admitted it, was tricking out their private vehicles. The guys with their pickup trucks and jeeps and 4x4s, under the law, they could put lights and sirens in their private vehicles. Of course, they had to pay for that out of their own pocket, but what was worth it was the sheer pleasure and adrenaline rush of getting toned out for a fire alarm and racing down the middle of Route 16 with lights flashing and sirens wailing. Even if it turned out to be a false alarm or a cat in a tree, there was nothing like that sheer jolt of pleasure that came from bailing out of work and hauling ass to the center of Walker Pond. So the guys in attendance at Ham and Bean Night, they weren't about to lose any of that over some tenant with a nice smile and lots of muscles and enthusiasm who would end up going back to wherever the hell he came from after Labor Day. Besides, some of the older, and yes, heavier, members of the department thought Russ Fox was out of place trying to horn in on being a volunteer firefighter after being up the lake for just a couple weeks. Well, that should have ended that, but as the old joke says, Russ Fox apparently didn't get the memo. It seems the day after that eventful ham and bean supper, and the events in that spiced ham are still being chatted about to this day, Russ Fox drove nearly an hour to the nearest Radio Shack, where he got a police fire scanner with the necessary frequencies. A few more beautiful sunny days passed, and then one June morning, word came from County Dispatch about a brush fire up on Cates Hill. The department responded and spent a good couple of hours knocking back the fire, wetting down the embers, cutting fire breaks so if something popped back up, it wouldn't spread.
And weren't the volunteers and customers surprised when they got back to the station? For there was Russ Fox waiting on him, with iced tea, iced coffee, a couple of dozen donuts from Dunkin' Donuts. He had a big grin on his face when the pumpers and forestry vehicle rolled back in, and the guys, and two gals, at least Gus wasn't stupid about letting a woman serve, were sweaty, hot, and covered with soot. They ate up and drank up and slapped Russ on the back, and he even helped unload their gear and wash the trucks. A couple of the more brave volunteers asked Gus to change his mind, but being an old-fashioned Yankee, a.k.a. a stubborn bastard who didn't want to admit being wrong, he said, "He starts paying a property tax bill, then he can join up. And a receipt from Dunkin' Donuts ain't no property tax bill." So that's how it went that long, glorious, warm, and wonderful summer, when the gas was relatively cheap and the motels and cottages around Walker Pond were fully rented. Whenever the Walker Pond volunteer fire department went out on a call, 2 in the morning on a Sunday, 3 p.m. on a Monday, dates and times scattered throughout the subsequent weeks, and no matter the type of call, car running into a pine tree, dump fire, or lost camper, Russ was always there at the station to provide refreshments and help with the cleanup. As the summer went on, more guys in the department told Gus that he should do something for Russ instead of being a stickler for rules. And like the true Yankee he was, nope, he was marching and he was in step, and it was the 24 other fellows who were out of step, he wouldn't do a damn thing. In fact, after one training session on the best way to use a power tool to open up a crumpled car door, Gus said, "That guy's just sucking up to us, that's all. He wants the badge and the honor of wearing a volunteer t-shirt, and it ain't going to happen. Mark my words, one of these days he's going to come here begging to join up, and I'm going to tell him to go straight to hell, that we can't be bought." But that day never came. Russ kept on helping out where he could. He still apparently entertained a number of local women, and twice, during more him and Bean suppers that were used as fundraisers, he brought along his spiced ham, and both times he brought larger portions because they were so damn popular. And even then, smiling and rags quacking and helping with the cleanup, he never revealed the recipe. As the glory days of July slid into the fat, warm days of August, and the local corn on the cob began appearing at dinner tables, two little things occurred that caused a few people to take notice. Not a lot of notice, mind you, but enough to stir up the gossipers at the Grange and the fire station and Miss Walker Diner. The first occurrence was when a heavyset guy came by from Massachusetts, looking for two fellas out of Chelsea, Massachusetts. It seemed they were up at Walker Pond on vacation some weeks prior, and got into a discussion of sorts with a local in a kayak, who apparently issued some sort of threat while they were minding their own business, enjoying the rays and some brews on a pontoon boat. The two boys, Tony and Andre, decided they were going to come back up to Walker Pond and teach that local guy a lesson. Problem was, they never came back to Chelsea. Never. Eventually, the two families went to the police, but since being missing wasn't a crime, and there was no sign of foul play, they just politely nodded and took a report. The families then hired the heavyset guy, who was an honest-to-God private detective, who asked them questions and poked around, but eventually left the area, with nothing to report. It seemed like Tony and Andre had vanished, either on the way up to New Hampshire or when they got there. One would think that having a PI stop by would cause a fair number of tongues to wag, but as it turned out, such was not the case. It seemed like most people couldn't bring themselves to think that the laughing and cheerful Russ Fox, who was doing so much for the town that summer, would have anything to do with the disappearance of those two knuckleheads. And those who thought differently obviously kept their mouths shut. A week after the Massachusetts PI left, Connie DeMint came home and leave from Afghanistan, where she served as a nurse, saving lives and patching up the wounded. She was on a long leave and was having a grand time, and she knew to Russ Fox going out every morning on his long jogs. One morning, over waffles and sausage links at the Miss Walker Diner, she chimed in when some folks were saying that Russ looked strong enough to run to Concord and back if he wanted to. And Connie said, staring two sugars into her black coffee, "That running don't make sense." A couple of the other folks in the diner said, "Well, Connie, what are you talking about?" She brought a cup of coffee up and said, "Most runners I know like to stick to one or two routes. That way, they can keep track of their progress. They can match their times against other runs. But this fella, he's running all over around the damn lake, every paved road and dirt lane. It's like he's looking for something. Or someone." More questions were raised, but Connie refused to rise to any bait, and finished her breakfast and spent the rest of her time on leave, sunning and swimming and reading lots of books. And as the heat wave rolled through towards the end of August, that was the end of Connie's speculation until the incident happened. The call came into the Walker Pond Volunteer Fire Department at 1:02 a.m. on an early Sunday morning, a structure fire at the end of Olson Road. The call was placed by Ruth Garrison, who was up at that hour to use the powder room and get a shot of gin to help her go back to sleep. It being so late at night, the phone call went to the fire station and was automatically forwarded to the county dispatcher about 20 miles away. The county dispatcher sent out a signal to the tone alert radios that the fire department members all carried with them. That hour of the night, the bulk of the volunteer force is in bed, or about to go to bed, and those who weren't hammered by spending a few hours at the Walker Pub and Grub jumped in the cars and trucks and drove with lights flashing and sirens wailing to the fire station, where they parked haphazardly and started running to the station, turning on the lights and opening up the garage bay doors. But one volunteer firefighter, Harry Pearson, lived at the other end of Olson Road, and instead of driving all the way into town and to the fire station, he gathered up his helmet, boots, and turnout gear and raced up the narrow and bumpy road to the house. And as he drove up a rise and bumped his head on the roof of his Chevy pickup truck, he saw a billowing glow of orange in the sky. Once he got to the scene and skidded to a halt, he got on a department-issued handheld radio and called in, "Hurry the hell up, guys! It's Kurt Dunson's place, and it's fully involved!" Which it certainly was. Kurt Dunson's little cottage was on a rise of land overlooking Walker Pond, and was built one story with a crawling attic and a dirt basement. It had four rooms on the first floor and an enclosed porch, and when Harry made the call, fire and smoke were billowing out from every window in the front door. Harry got out of his truck, overwhelmed at what he's seeing, frozen in place, because he sure as shit wasn't going to run into that cottage by himself. And he brought up his handheld radio again and said louder, "Guys, get the lead out! There's a hell of a fire up here!" And Gus Demers, chief of the department, called back to Harry and said, in a manner quite opposite to his usual cool demeanor during a call, "Shut your damn mouth! We get there as soon as we can! We can't move a damn piece of equipment!" Which was true, for when the volunteer firefighters, bankers, carpenters, retirees, store clerks, and so forth, got into the station and started up their pumpers to respond to the danger in the little hometown, each fire pumper, and even the forestry truck and the ambulance, were resting on flat tires. All of them. 16 flat tires. And no, somebody just didn't let the air out, which would meant a slight delay as the air was pumped back into the tires. Nails had been driven to each tire. They weren't going anywhere for a long, long time. So frantic phone calls and radio messages were sent out, and the county dispatch toned out the volunteer fire departments in the three towns around Walker Pond, which meant a long delay because those guys and gals had to get out of bed, get in their cars and trucks, drive to their respective stations, start up their equipment, and begin going balls to the walls over to Olson Road. But while this was going on, the smart, angry, and inventive volunteers back at Walker Pond weren't standing around scratching each other's butts, waiting for their neighbors to roll in and save the day. Nope, Chief Demers, who despite his stubbornness and refusal to embrace any technology less than 50 years old, was pretty good damn good when it came to emergencies. He told Carl Salucci to back up his heavy-duty Ford pickup truck with expanded cab to the near equipment bay. Then they all clustered in the rear where a mobile Morrison-type 5A water pump was stored, along with some other equipment, a pump that could send out 500 gallons of water per minute without breaking into a sweat. The salesman who sold the pump and displayed its tech specs cautioned the chief and others that because of its weight and size, it should only be transported using an overhead chain hoist. But the guys and gals weren't in the mood to dick around with the tech specs. The chief picked five strong guys and one strong gal, Gail Simmons, who was a stonemason and lifted weights for a hobby, and they picked up that heavy damn thing and got it into the rear of Carl's pickup truck. And about 1 second after the tailgate was slammed shut, Carl roared off and led a convoy of firefighters up to Olson Road. Carl was moving so fast, in fact, that at the intersection of Mast Road and Olson Road, his front right fender clipped a stone wall, and it showed how dedicated Darrell was that he didn't stop, because he loved that damn truck and washed and waxed it every Sunday morning. The crew got up to Kurt Dunson's house and they moved quickly, the same strong six grabbing the pump off the truck, moving as close to possible to the lakeshore, while other guys hitched together lengths of 3-inch hose and, with a strainer attached to one end, dropped it into the cold, still waters of the lake. The pump's engine started right up, the chief being a bear when it came to testing equipment, and within 5 minutes of their arrival, water was finally billowing out onto Kurt's cottage. And 2 minutes later, the roof collapsed. And 10 minutes after that, the first fire trucks from their neighbors arrived to help them contain and put out the fire. But to this day, it's still a point of pride for the members of the Walker Pond Volunteer Fire Department that they were the first to put water on the fire, even after all their equipment had been sabotaged. Then the state fire marshal showed up a couple hours later, as wood chunks and embers and nearby tree branches were being watered down. And things got really interesting when the charred remains of Kurt Dunson was found in the debris of his bedroom. But that was just the start of interesting things to come. Some hours later in the day on Sunday, the discouraged yet proud volunteer firefighters made their way back to the fire station, and there was nobody to greet them. Strike that, some wives and girlfriends were there, but no Russ Fox with coffee, tea, and donuts. No one's too sure who said it first, but it's a matter of public record that a phone call to the Walker Pond Police Department was made shortly thereafter, and a race ensued to see who would get to Russ Fox's rented house first. Police officials or one angry and pissed off mob of volunteer firefighters. But the truth is, they weren't the first ones there. The first ones there were a mother and daughter home cleaning crew, Molly's Merry Maids, and they were just finishing up a cleaning session at the Tucker house. There was no Russ Fox. There was no belongings or anything else that Russ Fox attached to them. Even the trash had been removed, and later, investigators from the state police and the FBI, can you believe it, the FBI, talked to Molly Green and her daughter Mabel, and they both told the same story, that Russ Fox had arranged for them to come on a Sunday morning and give the place a good cleaning. The funny thing is, Molly later told friends, that the place was spotless when we got there, but he paid us double to come on a Sunday morning, and he paid us triple to make sure we did a really good job of washing, vacuuming, and polishing. At the monthly Grange Hall meeting, somebody asked Molly if Russ had paid in cash, and she said, "Christ, but as far as I'm concerned, the IRS don't need to know that." The state police and FBI started digging into Russ Fox's background, and it was like digging into a foundation made of diamonds. Nothing, absolutely nothing, was ever found about who he was or where he came from. Hell, people couldn't even recall the license plates he had for his Ford Escort. Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, take your pick. And there weren't even any photographs of him taken during his time in town. And with his efforts and the efforts of Molly's Merry Maids, there was not a single bit of trace evidence, hair, fibers, fingerprints, left at the house. Oh, but one thing was left at the house, and that was a set of keys to the place, left behind about 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Bud Henniker, who was chairman of the local board of selectmen, he told the Boston Globe newspaper 2 weeks after the fire, "Damn, it was like he was a ghost up there. A damn polite ghost, but a ghost nonetheless." But that wasn't the end of the ghost stories. The state fire marshal spent nearly a week at Kurt Dunson's place, and though his guts and experience had told him that this had been an arson, well, there were no clues or evidence that pointed to arson. Nothing. No accelerants, no timers attached to gas containers, nothing. "Christ, for all I could tell," he told the state police and FBI, "the guy could have gone out because of spontaneous combustion." And that might have been it, a tale of arson, disabled fire vehicles, and a kind mystery man who rented a home for the summer, except a new guy attached to the FBI decided to do some digging into Kurt Dunson. And by God, Kurt Dunson turned out to be a ghost as well. Most people in town just knew him as some older gent, polite, who moved in years ago and kept his mouth shut and only appeared here and there to gas up his truck or get some groceries. He paid his property tax bill on time, with cash, and never went to town meeting or any other town function. Some folks called him the Hermit of Olsen Road and figured, if that's the way he wanted it, fine. But as the FBI agent dug and dug, he ran into the same barriers as before, when they tried to track down Russ Fox, i.e. no evidence the guy ever existed. No records, no files, nothing. But the FBI guy had one advantage, and that was the man's charred skull and teeth. As the FBI agent was fruitlessly chasing down leads, he also had the man's dental records checked out. And that's when things really got exciting that summer at Walker Pond. For Kurt Dunson wasn't Kurt Dunson. His name was Marko Petrovic, and for the last 20 years or so, he had been hunted as a war criminal. It seemed that during the Bosnian War, the man called Marko was in charge of a paramilitary group that specialized in such nasty deeds that the Walker Pond Chronicle couldn't dare mention in print. When that story came out, oh my, the news media hordes descended upon Walker Pond for the rest of the summer, talking and retalking to the volunteer firefighters, the selectmen, the police officers, and even people from away who were just spending a weekend at the lake. And the story was all the same, about a mysterious assassin who came to Walker Pond, made friends with the local fire department, figured out how long it took for them to respond to calls, and how to get into the station, and also spent weeks quietly jogging around the lake until he found where the war criminal was living. But who was Russ Fox? Lots of theories, from the CIA to MI6 to intelligence agencies all over Europe, to maybe even a freelancer who was looking to gain revenge for family still grieving there back over in the Balkans. So the summer ended, and the mystery remained a mystery, till one more puzzle popped up to both dismay and amuse the good people of Walker Pond. The envelopes arrived over the course of 3 weeks, mailed from Key West, Kansas City, Detroit, and other cities and towns across the nation. In each envelope was a white sheet of paper, and each folded sheet of paper was a money order for $500. The envelopes had no other messages, and the careful block printing addressed them to the Walker Pond Volunteer Fire Department, and not to Chief Demers, a fair number of folks deserved, meaning that whoever Russ Fox was,
you still bearing a grudge for not being allowed to join the department. Pretty soon the money totaled more than enough to pay for the destroyed tires, and although the state police and the FBI tried to seize the funds, the town and its lawyer, a retired state Supreme Court justice who had a lot of pull in the state, managed to prevail, saying there was no clear evidence the money had come from Russ Fox. So the Walker Pond Volunteer Fire Department got reimbursed for their tires and even had a nice chunk of change left for the contingency fund. But the last envelope, mailed from a place called Arapahoe, Nebraska, didn't contain a money order. Nope, it contained a printed-out recipe for spice ham. Yet to this day, no matter how many times the fine women of Walker Pond try, their spiced hams never match the quality of the ones prepared by the man called Russ Fox. Just one more mystery that would never be solved, but would always be eagerly discussed.
The Lake Tenant is copyrighted by Brendan DuBois. Music for this podcast is by Jason Shaw and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQM.